Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. From economic development to income inequality, the answer you get to New Mexico's problems is improve education. But how do you do that when over 70% of our newborns qualify for Medicaid, and we are 49th in other indicators of child well-being, like teen pregnancies, low birth weight babies, and teen drug abuse? That's the question we'll put to former New Mexico Education Secretary Dr. Veronica Garcia and pediatrician Dr. Andrew Shee, who heads up an early childhood program at UNM Hospital that treats pregnant teens, drug users, and low birth weight babies. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Veronica, if I could start with you and ask you perhaps to take a step back from the question I posed at the start and just ask you to sort of describe for us the problems that poverty causes in terms of school achievement. Because we talk about pervasive poverty being a problem, but we don't always connect it to why it's a problem.
Well, there's so many correlates to poverty, and I've heard people say, well, you know, I grew up poor, and I did well, and I always say, well, you were lucky. You probably had a lot of supports and a whole different situation than so many children find themselves. So I'm just going to give you a couple of scenarios just to sort of think about a child living in poverty that maybe there's no food on the table, or parents are stressed out because they don't have jobs, or there is drug or alcohol abuse or domestic violence, or kids who are spent the night in a car or in a homeless shelter or come to school hungry or experience, and I think Dr. Shee will talk about this in a minute, just knowing what I've heard him talk about in terms of these impacts on brain development on children, on infants, and what that means for their achievement in school. So there is such a strong tie between poverty and brain development and not coming to kindergarten ready for school with a lot of the skills, the developmental milestones being so far behind due to poor nutrition. I mean, you could also talk about the nutrition of the mother, prenatally what happens to children, the need for more special education. I mean, the impacts go on and on.
You know, I don't know if you saw a frontline called Dropout Nation that was about the Houston school system, but by the end of the documentary, I was amazed that any of these kids graduated. Not that some of them didn't make it, but any of them made it.
It requires significant support. One of the things when I was secretary that we tried to do was a holistic approach. So looking at school-based health clinics, pre-K, breakfast in the schools, physical education, out-of-school time. Children in poverty need a lot of support, more time on task, kindergarten plus, 20 additional days of school, just to help give them a level playing field and to try to help mitigate the impacts of poverty.
So you've really just anticipated the question I was going to ask, because the question is, with more than 70% of kids qualifying for Medicaid, how can you really expect to achieve improvement in our schools?
Well, I think what we're learning more now, I think we knew it, but I think that the evidence is becoming abundantly clear that the earlier the intervention, that learning really starts at birth and really helping set a sound foundation in prenatal care for moms, ensuring that they have the appropriate medical care, proper nutrition, and so on, all the medical pieces that happen at that point, and then from birth on, in terms of home visiting and quality child care and quality pre-K, which is why our organization, New Mexico Voices for Children, is partnering with St. Joseph's Community Health and other partners in Invest in Kids Now, which has 25 organizations, are looking at substantial funding to help create a strong system of early learning and care.
Let me come back to that, but you gave me a perfect segue to bring Dr. Andrew Shee in, because it seems to me like you're really on the front line of what we're talking about with teen pregnancies, drug abuse, low birth weight babies. Maybe you could talk further about the problems that these kids, and their teens are still of school age, I take it, that they incur in trying to succeed in school.
Well, sure, Stephen. I think, you know, one important thing, and Veronica, I know, believes this as well, that being born poor does not imply what the child's future or the family's future is going to be. What it says is it's a red flag that resources that a kid needs to do well need to be examined very carefully. So in our work with families affected by substance use, alcohol, drugs, families affected by domestic violence, or where parents have mental illness, or teen parents who don't have support, we identify poverty as a factor in what's going on, but we also identify the fact that those families wanting the best for their kids are going to need specialized support services that both enhance the development of their child as well as protect the parents' health and help the parents change behaviors that could then cause adverse experiences for the child growing up. Let's take teen pregnancy as an example. Many of the young women who have babies at an early age are young women who have experienced tremendous difficulty in their lives growing up. I spoke to a young mom this morning in our clinic who talked about being raised by relatives who sexually abused her and her sisters. They kept running away from home. They'd get arrested, brought back to the home. Then they started fighting with the aunt and uncle because of sexual abuse. They went to jail. They went to treatment centers. There was nobody who believed their story about what was going on.
So this is a horrific story.
Horrific story. And this young woman is sharing this story with me as we're talking about her baby. And she has, at this point, realized that she has to tell the story, what happened to her that then led to things like having kids at a very early age, that led to untreated mental health problems, doesn't just come because she made bad choices or because she acted out, but because a whole series of things happened in her life that she now has to try to correct in terms of becoming a parent herself. It's real easy to look at people who have babies at an early age and forget that the risk-taking behaviors they're taking now have to do with trauma they experienced as kids.
So how do you deal with these problems? I mean, this sounds like something that's almost insoluble, and yet I know you've had success in your program.
Well, right. Well, the first thing that we have to do is congratulate her for bringing these things out into the open, because by putting a name to it means that people who are knowledgeable about how to help young women recover from trauma can get involved with her life. So what I offered her today was we could do her primary care. We'd be happy to see her to try to address the things that are going on, and we'd be happy to see her kids. And what I believe is that if we can help her kids be healthy and do things that help their development get better, that this mom will begin to believe that she has a capacity to carry out those things, and because she wants a good outcome for her kids, live a healthier life herself.
So it's not just medical, it's psychological and social as well.
That's right. It's tied together in a whole person. We're looking at how to take care of the body and mind simultaneously, and we're working in multiple generations in order to try to achieve those outcomes.
Steve, I don't know if you knew that I was a principal at New Future School, which was a school for pregnant parenting teens. And I think what Dr. Shi is talking about, that you have to have this holistic approach of support. You can break that cycle. But, you know, at New Futures, back when I was principal, I don't know if they still have all those services there, but we had school-based health clinic. Mm-hmm. We had social work services, mental health services. We had, you know, child development coaches. We had on-site nurseries, so they could learn how to interact with their baby appropriately, how to look for the appropriate developmental milestones, how to interact, how to bond with their child if they were having issues, breastfeeding, immunizations right there on site. They could get assistance. The social workers would come to the site. And so I think having this wraparound set of services as support can make a very big difference for these teen moms. But unfortunately, New Futures only serves maybe 200 young women, and the need in this state far exceeds that.
Just how, talking how big about, is your program, Andy?
In any given year, we're working with about 200 or 225 individual kids who are identified as our primary clients, but each kid usually comes with at least one parent and at least one other older child as well in the family. So it's a pretty big number of that group. We make home visits at least once a month, but when families are in crisis, we might see them as often as once a week in order to try to help stabilize things in the home. What Secretary Garcia is saying is so important, because that early first 3 years of life is when, for example, by age two, babies achieve 75% of the adult brain growth. So an incredible amount of neuronal development is happening in that period of time. But along with the development of all this brain growth, there's also a whole set of modifications and alterations going on in the connections that make a person the person that he or she will become. And if we can, for example, in the case of New Futures, help young women further their education so that they are going to be contributing in the economy of our society, not only are they doing that, but they're setting in a tremendous model for their young kids, saying, hey, look, things are tough. I finished school. When that kid comes to that mom at age 12 and say, I don't want to do homework or I don't want to go to school, that mom can look that kid right now and go, hey, Buster, I did it after I had you. I finished my degree. You are going to go to school, believe me.
So let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're very pleased to have on the show today former New Mexico Education Secretary, Dr. Veronica Garcia, and pediatrician Dr. Andrew Shi, who heads a special program at UNM Hospital that you've just heard him talking about. And I just want to come back to you briefly, Dr. Shi, because you talk about having at least 200 kids. Yeah, you're serving 200 kids, but what's the need in Bernalillo County for services like the service you provide? And what's the need all over the state for services you provide?
That's a great question. We think that somewhere between 1% and 15% of babies born in the state of New Mexico have exposure to drugs during the mother's pregnancy. We focus on drug use because there's a biological marker that we can identify that allows us to find high-risk families. So in the whole state of New Mexico, out of, say, 27,000 kids born a year, it could range from 2,700 kids to almost 7,000 kids who need the kind of services.
And you're servicing 200.
Correct. Yeah. Now, we have a bill in front of the Senate and House to try to expand our centers of excellence to other communities.
And there's no other center of excellence, right? There's only one, and the one you head here in Albuquerque right now.
That's correct. We have the Milagro program that does the comprehensive prenatal care and drug treatment services, coupled with the Focus program that I lead that provides the care for the mothers and babies after the babies are delivered, and we follow those kids up to 3 years of age.
So let me ask you a very similar question, Veronica, which is, you know, you talked about the need for all these services to kids that are dealing with these problems associated with poverty. But I read that only 3% of the 70% of kids that qualify for Medicaid are actually serviced by a home visiting. That means we're hardly doing any home visiting whatsoever in this state.
That's correct. And what Dr. Shi's talking about is a more comprehensive, you know, medical intervention. Home visiting helps them connect the mom, gives her someone to connect to, sort of like, how can I get additional services? Also coaching. Many young women find themselves with all of the stresses going through postpartum depression, let's say, to help, you know, they may not provide counseling, but they may be able to help the mother manage that or get her the appropriate supports. Gives her someone to call if, you know, there's domestic violence issues, let's say, at least there is someone else that she can talk to or know how she can get support and help her be able to interact with that baby.
Yeah, these home visiting programs, there's a trained home visitor that comes to a home like once a week under the St. Joe program.
Correct.
And first talks prenatally, right?
Correct.
And then comes to the home and does the very things that you're talking about.
Right. And, you know, kids don't come with an instruction manual. They need that support and that help. And many of our families that are living in poverty, many of them are dropouts themselves. Many of them may not have good literacy skills. So having that kind of support, someone to be able to go to, makes a huge difference.
For these home visiting programs, prenatal to three, that covers the first 3 years of life. And then there are programs called pre-K programs, which cover four-year-olds. And you were very instrumental in starting that, along with Lieutenant Governor Diane Danish.
And Mary Dill Bolson from CYFD. Mm-hmm.
But what I've read is that that's a very limited program. And it's been successful. It's been evaluated by Rutgers. It's doing well. But there's only 4,500 kids in the program.
That program has not been implemented and not funded to the level that we needed. What we felt would be an appropriate level was around 70 to 80% of the kids being in pre-K. And you know, we've only touched the surface there. In terms of 3 and 4 year olds, in terms of child care, we hope that there could be more funding for child care assistance. There are many parents and families that I think would like to work, but they can't afford it. You know, if you think of what you're paid in terms of minimum wage, I don't know if people are aware that child care without assistance costs as much or more than university tuition.
Funding is the big issue. And I don't think people, I certainly didn't really grasp how big an issue it was. If you take home visiting, which is about the cheapest program you can get because you're going to the homes, you don't have a center, right? on most home visiting programs. St. Joe's is trying to get that down to $3,000 a year. If you say 70% of the, say, the 26,000 kids, 75% of the 26,000 kids that are born, that would leave 20,000 kids. If it's $3,000 a kid, you're talking $60 million. If it's another 2 years of early child care, 0 to 5, you're talking about another $120 million. Okay, that's $300 million. There's not $300 million sitting around the general fund. And I would contrast that with, and I'm not trying to criticize the governor. The governor says she wants to expand early childhood programs, five-year-olds to grade three, with $17 million. That's about $3 million per age level. That comes down to another 500 kids in pre-K and nothing for home visiting. So the problem is the money just isn't there.
Right. I mean, the need is significant for a full compendium of services, looking at early learning through kindergarten, would be roughly about $388 million. Current state funding is about $102 million. So that leaves a $274 million gap. And what I think we need to recognize is as we make investments, investing in early learning pays off in terms of people that can hold down jobs, have better health, better quality of life for all of us, less crime, and people that are paying taxes, right, and contributing, not to mention the economic development in terms of job growth that these programs create, but then also having people that are employable. That is a big issue.
Yeah, you hear about these returns that are fantastic. 4 to 7 to 1, just to the state, not to the people, not to the families, not to the economy, but the state saves $4 for every, or $7, up to $7 for every dollar invested. But let me come back to you now, Andy, because you mentioned something earlier about the cognitive and really non-cognitive development of babies. And the question I have really is, you know, the one thing we're not doing is early childhood programs in New Mexico. Should we now turn and try to do those programs, or should we continue concentrating on what we're concentrating on? And really, I ask you this from the point of view of cognitive and non-cognitive development. But before you answer that, let me just mention, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm talking with Andy Shee, he's a pediatrician, and Dr. Veronica Garcia, she is the former New Mexico Education Secretary. So what do you think in terms of where we should be putting our resources?
Well, that's a great question. I think what we're really talking about is a series of building the baby's brain and building the baby's emotional capacity step by step. So the home visiting programs that Secretary Garcia is describing are so important because what they do is begin to provide parents with appropriate ways of interacting with their child to develop the foundational parts of the brain so that future cognitive learning can happen. The child care components and the pre-K components are important because what they start introducing children to are specific areas of learning that are going to be necessary to be able to be competitive in the formal education model. Let me give you an example of that. There's data that says that if we look at kids between 7 months and 30 months and look at their language production, those kids who have higher levels of language production and are able to communicate more effectively will have better educational outcomes by 8th grade. So this whole building process that we could put into place to help families know how to stimulate and motivate that part of the baby's brain that learns how to express itself and how to talk would have payoffs down the line some, 13 years later. It needs different levels of individuals working with that family in order to make that happen. And so in a sense, the question of how much to spend and where to spend it is also partly tied to what are the exact kinds of services that we'd want to provide that would have the biggest impact for the dollar amount spent.
And so the implication behind what you're saying is yes for early childhood, but let me ask you directly, is that what you're saying? I mean, there's a lot of need throughout K through 12, right?
Absolutely a lot of need. But yes, the joint memorial talking about using the permanent fund to support early childhood would be incredibly important for the state to pass because of what we know about brain development and what we know needs to happen to raise New Mexico kids in a way that they are going to be competitive in the economy of ideas.
Let me ask you, Veronica, a question about the permanent fund, because I have seen so much misinformation about the permanent fund from commentators, even the Albuquerque Journal editorial staff, because they seem to confuse the tax severance fund with the land grant permanent fund. And the land grant permanent fund is the fund that Dr. Shih is just referring to as the permanent fund. That can only be used for education. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not a rainy day fund. It can't be used for bonding. It can't be used for capital projects. It's been growing at more than 12% for 20 years. You either use it or you just continue to, I guess, a sense, be miserly and let it grow and, I don't know, count your money.
You're absolutely right. People say, well, we need to save it for emergencies, but it can only be used for education. And I think if we look at where education is today, and we've tried various things and we've made some incremental, very small improvements, but to not put the focus early on where I think the research show that it creates the best payoff for your investment would be penny wise and pound foolish to not move forward with that. There are safeguards in the legislation that if the fund were to go to a certain point, that the legislature can stop those disbursements. I think what the constitutional amendment does is allow the public to have good public policy debate about it and let New Mexicans decide. A poll that was conducted in 2011 showed significant support that New Mexicans believe that an investment in early learning was important. And so my message to legislators is to allow the citizens of New Mexico to decide. And I really believe that they would vote in favor of investing early in our children.
Yeah, and we should say what the constitutional amendment, I think as it's now framed, would be an extra 1% from the land grant permanent fund that would be distributed to early childhood programs 0 to 5. And that would be right now, since the fund is at about $11.5 billion, that would be another $110 million. But, you know, let me just push back on this one area because it's troublesome to me, and that is if you look at what President Obama went to Georgia, there's a pre-K program in Georgia that's been going since 1995, so much more than 15 years. Their high school graduation rate is exactly like our high school grad. It's one of the lowest in the country, 67%. So, you know, is this really a panacea? And I've read other things which trouble me, which say when you scale up these programs, when you go from your programs, you're talking about programs for 200 or 300 kids, when you go to the thousands, you no longer get these incredible benefits. You get much lower benefits, like 5%, nothing significant, really. So what's your reaction to that?
I think you have to ensure that you have good accountability built into, like for the Pre-K Act, there is accountability built into it, the requirements for training or certification of those providing the services. So quality of program, I think, is really key.
But they all want quality, right?
And accountability. They don't all get it. But you have to manage that through legislation and regulation. You just can't say, well, here's funding for a Pre-K program. And you have to have well thought out programs that have high quality standards. The same is true for childcare. We've just worked on the quality rating improvement system for childcare and the levels of service that they need to meet, the kinds of conditions that have to be available in those classrooms. It's not just babysitting. And the same for home visiting. Home visiting is just like, hi, how's the baby? There are certain standards and types of standards that need to be followed for quality home visiting.
Let me bring Andy in. And what's your reaction? Because, you run a wonderful program here at UNM Hospital, but when it's expanded to thousands of kids, these programs tend to lose their fidelity, despite what Veronica has just said, all these efforts to keep the fidelity.
Well, sure. No, I think in our program, for example, of the families we take care of, we expect that about a quarter of that group of families will get it almost immediately and begin to do things in a way that's benefits their child. Talked to a mom today in our clinic who said basically she'd had this decade-long heroin habit. She had this baby. Before this baby, she basically got into jail, come out of jail, started using right away. Nothing worked. Now she has a baby. She's breastfeeding this baby. She says, the thing that's helping me stay straight is knowing that I can provide for my child and that nobody else can, and that's a motivation for me to do well. Boy, when that starts, that opens so many doors for us in terms of helping her. On the other hand,
you know, it's funny because what I read is that this concentration on bureaucratic standards isn't the key. The key is exactly what you're talking about, the direct communication with the mothers and with the babies.
Right. If we look at schools, now because this is a conversation about ideas, I think we have to think about education a little differently because currently what we have is a fairly industrial model of education where kids all start kindergarten at age 5. They're all promoted based on their age. There are all sorts of literature and data like Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers that would suggest that kids mature at different rates and that what we need to begin doing if we are in an information-driven economy is begin to think about kids entering formal education and optimizing their passage through that education, not based on their age, but based on competence. So instead of talking about looking at third graders and whether they can read or not and then holding them back, a group of those kids mature so that they will read better and pass, but a group of those kids won't. We need to start much earlier and look at the individual needs of those kids without thinking of them as a widget moving through an education system. If we begin to do that at a very individualized level, starting in infancy, and begin to work with especially high-risk families, the families at highest risk for bad education outcome, for bad adverse events with child abuse and child neglect happening are those families we can identify based on markers like drug use during pregnancy. And if we begin to specifically focus our efforts on that high-risk group, I think we can move a bigger portion of those kids into a much better place as they get ready for school.
So another perfect segue, because we're nearing the end of the show, Dr. Garcia. And I'd like you to sort of speculate for me. What do you think New Mexico is going to look like in terms of education and early child care over the next decade?
Well, I think the problem is going to be, and I've been in education 40-some years, and you talk to anyone who's been trained in education, know that children, that this whole grading system is arbitrary and doesn't make any sense pedagogically and child development-wise. You try to marry education with the business community and government, elected officials that really, you know, accountability, we have to test these kids according to standards and everyone's supposed to be in this place. And I think that's where you see a lot of pushback from teachers about teaching to the test or being held to these accountability standards, not so much that they don't want to be held accountable, but we know that so much of that's arbitrary and really unfair to children and that children distribute on a normal distribution and we're just setting some kids up to failure and that they're all going to be maturing at different levels. And so particularly in those primary years, it makes a lot of difference. I think that part of the reason that the whole idea of virtual learning and online learning, why it's so popular and why a lot of children are successful with it is because it's self-paced. Some kids can go through the material very quickly and others may need more time and the teacher is more like an individual coach rather than trying to get everyone to do everything at the exact same time.
So do you think
but
we're going to go to this more flexible system?
I wish we would. I believe in my heart that that's what we ought to do.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank my two guests, Dr. Veronica Garcia and Dr. Andrew Shee. Also thanks to my producer, Joe Green. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. My name is Stephen Spitz. Podcasts of my recent shows are on iTunes. Search for Stephen Spitz. Archives of all my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.